Hey everybody, it's John Bollinger from Premier Guitar. If you're into pedals, then you know what it's like to spend an entire evening perfecting your pedal board. And then you play a couple gigs and realize you want to add something or take it away. And that's why I love the Dario's expanding pedal boards. They grow with your setup or shrink to fit your needs. I also love their flat patch cables with zero interference. The Dario understands the mindset of every player. I'm John Bollinger with Premier Guitar. Today we're at the Sony Studios in Nashville. I'm with Charlie Worsham. Charlie, hey man.
Hey,
thanks,
John.
Thanks for meeting us today.
Man, glad to be here with y'all.
Well, I know this is a busy day. You're finishing up your album right now, yeah. In the midst of the end of the tracking anyway.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, for now.
Yeah,
right?
For now. It never ends,
until
right?
We decide, oh, we need to dust that one off, you know.
Yeah, right. But, and then there's the next record, and the
that's
one after
right.
that. Hey, tell me about this guitar.
Yeah, I figured this would be the perfect guitar to start with. This is the first really nice and vintage instrument I've ever owned, and it was a very thoughtful gift from my parents.
That's great.
I was sort of getting real serious about music, and we would come up to Nashville. I grew up in North Mississippi, about a five-hour drive from Nashville, and in my growing up years, Grooving Guitars was downtown, you
right.
know, where you'd see the Ryman,
sure.
Ernest Tubb Record Shop.
Which is now Dierks Bentley's.
It's now Dierks Bentley's bar, which is kind of a funny full circle for me.
Right,
but it's where I used to go and bought my first electric guitar there. I had $500 saved up. The guitar was $600, so I went out on the street and played banjo for tips for two hours.
And you made the
got $100 in tips. Went in and
wow.
bought my first electric.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, but this guitar, I was obsessed with it. I was sitting there in the showroom playing this guitar. It was probably September or something. And then at Christmas that year, they surprised me with this 63 D28. It's got the Brazilian rosewood on the back and sides. And what's funny, and these are those things that kid versions of ourselves get obsessed with, it was the pick guard for me.
Right.
That was the thing that sold it. The other Martin I was playing had a black pick guard, and that was not nearly as interesting. But I love this guitar. And some number of years ago, probably 12, 13 years ago, I took it in to get refretted at a guitar store in town. And while it was there, some freak accident happened. A truck bumped into the building. This was hanging on the wall, fell and broke into a million pieces. And I had just quit a band I was in. I was making a living playing on my first sessions. And this was the only great instrument I had. And they were like, well, there's only one guy that can fix it, and it'll take him 6 months. And so I took a check for the guitar and let him take it, let him take this instrument, which was not a great move. Months later, I walk in the shop, and there's this guitar rebuilt.
Wow.
And I pick it up, and I pull out the plastic and walk out with that guitar because I couldn't let it go. So yeah. The guitar's so nice, I acquired it twice.
Oh,
you know?
That's great. But, so how did it sound after the rebuild? Was there much of a difference? Because it sounds
yeah.
the room. I wish you all could hear the thing.
It's really popping. I think it sounded pretty good, but I'll say, I mean, that was a good 10 years ago, and I took it with me all sorts of places I probably shouldn't have, and this was before I knew about the power of humidification in the wintertime.
Sure.
And so just about a year ago, I took it to my buddy Dave Johnson in town, and he really fixed her up. And the ball ends of these strings were digging into the wood under the saddle there and under the bridge, and it was
61
just sucking
years.
Out. Yeah, yeah, it was just kind of sucking out a lot of the tone. So he got that fixed up, got it set up, and feels like a real bluegrass box.
Good, now, yeah, it sounds amazing. Yeah. And great guitar playing. That is,
well, thank you.
That's too, okay, that is a great guitar. Now, what strings are you running on?
I love the new D'Addario, is it XS?
Yeah.
I'm not a coated string guy. But when they came out with those, a couple people I trust said, give it a shot. And I love the bluegrass gauge. So these three are mediums, these three are light.
Oh.
Although I like a medium gauge too. I like a guitar that fights back sometimes. But right now the bluegrass gauge seems to fit for this one.
Now, you run a pickup in this as well. What?
Yes. I just got this one outfitted with the LR Bags Hi-Fi, which I love for, you know, if I'm playing, say, a station in or like a listening room. It's just very pristine and true to the sound of the instrument, and I love the LR Bags voice print DI that I'll use with that modeling, using the model I did of this guitar. For some of my guitars, though, I have the Anthem, and then I need to pop it out of my gig bag over there, but I have one of those George L. pop-in pickups that I keep with me. So years ago, I saw this band, the Davison Brothers, play, a band out of West Virginia, and they've got roots here in Nashville, too.
Yeah, I know those guys.
Yeah, and Chris Davison would play this rocking set with a full band and play slide, like, through a tube screamer on an electric or an acoustic.
Marshall.
Sounded like an electric, and I took notes, and I noticed he had the sound hole pickup. And those George L's, you know, they don't sound great technically. Yeah. It's just the mids, but that's exactly what you need.
Yeah, they only give you that mid.
What you need for that, and so I then began this long love affair of miking or amplifying acoustics, especially when I go in to make my own records or the more creative records I play on, folks who are not necessarily wanting to stick to the traditional acoustic tones, you know. And you can get some really cool stuff. My pedal board is literally changes by the hour.
Sure, that's not uncommon.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the crayon box, right? And I have I started with the 16 crayon box, and then I acquired the other 32 or 48 crayons. Yeah. So they're all switching out. But, you know, I love these, like, Strymon delays where I can hold this down and get that infinite, you know, just for transitions and stuff on records. I love a good long tail reverb. You know, whatever is getting called for.
Oh, that is so dreamy.
And live, it really comes in handy. I noticed Jed Hughes playing years ago with the original Basement.
Yeah.
Here in Nashville, and it was just him solo acoustic, but he brought a little Fender combo amp with a lot of reverb, and his acoustic signal got split between the DI and that amp, and it just allows you to do so much more as a solo performer,
right?
And just get a bigger sound.
And you're not entirely dependent on the engineer. You can actually,
too.
You know,
yeah, you
got a little
that.
Control. You can turn it up, turn it down, wet it down.
Exactly.
Hey, since we kind of got into it, I want to go through all, you got some other instruments I want to hit, but as long as you mention it, let's just take me through this pedal board right
now. Absolutely. Most important part of this whole thing is right here. Thank you, Tom Bukovac, for teaching me how important it is to be properly in tune and to have a proper tuner. And I love the Sonic Research. I bet I got half a dozen of those guys, the mini and the regular size. It's just a great, trusty tuner. And then this board, I actually only more recently have been bringing this into the studio. I've got a bigger board with a bunch of funky pedals I keep at home now.
Yeah.
And this is more of a live setup. And even more recently, I reconfigured it just for solo acoustic stuff, not electric so much. But when I'm out these days, this Protein and the Muellner, sort of their clone, I guess you could call it.
Yeah. So what was say that first one, the Protein?
Yeah, the Protein. I forget who makes that.
What's it do?
Well, it's got two different kind of drives, John. I don't know exactly what they do. There's the green one.
Oh, yeah.
The blue one and the green one. I think this is a little bit tube screamer, and this is like a blues driver-ish kind of thing.
And you do use this with your electric rig as well?
I do,
Between them both.
Yeah, and lately it's just kind of been my go-to for having as many options and gain stages for throw and go live gigs on a small board that I can fly with, you know.
Do you use the dirt on your acoustic at all?
Big time. That's a big thing I love to do.
Well,
and I need to make sure this doesn't.
I want to hear this madness.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, here we go. Let's see. Oh. Don't need that, do we? Here we go. That's not necessarily dialed in or anything, but it does help to have that just clean mic signal and then some dirt to back it up.
God, know? That's great, man.
But
yeah, like that old Delta funky
big
dirty
time.
Stuff.
Big
yeah,
time. It's
great.
A big Mississippi influence.
Yeah,
for sure.
Totally. Okay, love that. All right, that's great. And then what's next in along the?
This little Guyatone compressor. Once again, thank you, Jed Hughes. Jed and I were out in 2019 playing in Vince Gill's touring band. And I guess Jed and Vince had gotten hip to these compressors. And for that really clean, you know, this is not the right guitar to kind of showcase it, but it's just a really cool, squishy compressor.
Yeah.
Jed had an extra and was like, hold on to this. And, so, and then a couple years later, I had a pedal. I was like, take that, you know. It's that fun, like, friendship pedal exchange, the co-op, you know.
Yeah.
And then this Electro Harmonix Canyon, I was looking for a way to get some reverse delay, be able to tap tempo it, and it's
great.
So versatile, you know. I mean, I am a part-time snob of like a true old memory man, like you're just not going to beat that tone.
Yeah.
But I mean, this gets you so close.
Oh,
and so many options.
And it's that big
and
compared
it's that
to
big.
That
yes.
big. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that pedal. They're
great. I've been really, really happy with it. And then, of course, this warped vinyl, you know, the Chase Bliss stuff is great. I've only just scratched the surface with what those pedals can really do. But I love the warped vinyl. I love his version of the tremolo that he does. I've got two or three of his pedals. The Strymon, I'm actually a Brigadier guy. But this El Capistan is great because you can... fold in a little bit of reverb if you want on that one with that sort of slapback sound. That's so cool. And the new Neighbor Immerse, man, I love long tail reverbs. Like if I'm doing something of my own, like a song of mine, Mississippi in July. Just having that behind
right.
me, you know.
Oh yeah,
really helps.
Isn't that something? You play something like that and then you just get an acoustic alone and it sounds so empty.
I know. Yeah, you have to be careful. I have to remind myself to practice sometimes without all the training wheels, you know.
Yeah. They're great. Okay, well, great. Well, we might even let's look at some more guitars and we might even circle back with your electric.
Absolutely.
And that thing.
Let's
so
do.
what's next on your
so this Martin and then this J50 I'm going to grab are I mostly get called to play acoustic, and these are my two go-tos, and I love this J50. I've probably played this acoustic on more records than any other guitar. And when I took the check for that Martin before I bought it back, I spent the money on this.
Oh,
and
God, that was... Well done. Got them both.
Hey, thanks. I know, it kind of felt like I rounded it out. You
yeah.
know? Now, I did fall prey to, this had the really bad glue in it, and it was starting to turn to dust, so about 7 years ago, it's almost like I had to buy this one again.
So is it
to
like
get
a
it
50s era?
54. Okay. Yeah, 54. Bought it at Gruen's, downtown, same thing. And then probably a good time now to talk about my EQ pedals over here.
Oh, yeah.
In that, you know, so much of whatever decent knowledge I have comes from the session player community here, and Brian Sutton is the one who hipped me to the fact that your picks are your EQ, especially on acoustic instruments, and that led me to get down the rabbit hole on vintage Fender picks before the whatever polymers or whatever the new plastics are, and I've slowly morphed into a shoulder of the pick guy. But that's also another choice, you know. This Fender Medium is just good, like middle of the road, like works great for strumming and for like pop country, like radio music. But it's got enough on it, you can sneak a little bit of picking in still, and it'd be good for that. And then, of course, that's just the, you know, right there is crazy, just the difference.
Right.
But
so
then,
where do you source old Fender picks?
Oh, just get online, and it's a huge, like, eBay and, yeah. you know, all the typical.
And those are the ones that burn, those old Fender picks.
Have you, oh, they, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. They literally will just, like...
Maybe it's the pyro in me, but yeah, the old ones really, really burn.
They catch fire, okay.
You have to light them on fire.
But, of course, but still, yeah. If you're in the woods, you don't have two sticks to rub together. You just need a vintage Fender. This Fender Thin is like my go-to for super like windshield wipery strumming parts, you know. These Ultexes, which I've been obsessed with for a while. This is a whole inside joke. I don't know if y'all can see this, but you know, I play in the summers with Dirk Spentley and his touring band, and sometimes we'll book gigs as a bluegrass version of ourselves at Station Inn, and Dirk's running bit is at the end of a burning bluegrass instrumental. He'll act like he's going to play a solo. He isn't really going to go play a solo, but it's right as the band ends the song, and then he gets all upset, you know, pretend upset. You know, guys, I was just about to play the best solo, so much better than all of you. But you stopped the song, and so we'll start the song back up. And he's like, no, the moment's passed. I was like, no, we'll play. And he's like, I have my strumming pick. I don't have my lead pick. So one day I got a bunch of these Ultexes, which I use a lot anyway, and I made an official Dirk Spentley lead pick to his specifications, 7 9/4. And so that day, he's like, well, I don't have my lead pick. We all pulled a whole handful of lead picks out of our pocket, you know. But I love the mid-range you get on these. And there's these Dunlops. I forget exactly what they're called, but I've now used these a lot. This is the thinner of the thinnest of the three gauges I have for these. So good strumming pick. I use a thicker one usually so I can finger pick a little more, and I gotta have a blue chip or some kind of a bluegrass. There's a great one that Martin makes that I use a lot. Especially
yeah,
on that
great.
Martin, you know, it kind of pulls out the
the
bottom end you need for that. But yeah, that's my EQ.
Yeah,
section.
That's so great. I'm amazed by it when I see some guys who are like, they only play like those little red jazz things
right.
all the time, or what? I mean, they're very loyal to one pick.
Right.
And I feel like you're missing out.
I think so. Well, I mean, just especially you know when you look at acoustic chair in the studio, you know. You don't necessarily have the pedal board. You know, this only comes with me if I know who the producer is and I know they want that.
Oh, yeah.
So these are my pedals.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love this J50.
Yeah, what a great guitar. Now, when you're touring with Dirk Spentley, I imagine your rig's on the road all the time. You only see it at gigs. But is it similar kind of...
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes and no. You know, I mean, it's similar in like what I'm the type of or the models of guitars I tend to play. You know, Gibson's been really kind to me to sort of outfit me with most everything I need out there.
Oh, great.
So I've got one of their like J35s. I've got a J45 because most of what I play is acoustic. Got a great 12-string acoustic, and then a Deering. Ganjo, which I am a 5-string banjo player, and I have one with me, and I can prove it. But you know, the Ganjo, I am a open-minded dude when it comes to that. I think there's a lot to be said for being able to play the 5-string banjo, Scruggs style, which is what I picked up before I ever touched a guitar. But you know, the range and the tone and what purpose a ganjo serves is totally valid.
Oh right, yeah. I mean, thanks to Keith Urban, everybody
exactly.
in town. 20 years ago, every guitar player had to buy one.
That's right.
Yeah. And they're cool, man.
They're so super cool. And Dirk, one of my favorite Dirk songs we play is Am I the Only One? And it's Bukovac playing a banjo. And you couldn't do that on a regular banjo.
Yeah.
So I got that. I've got a great Les Paul that Gibson lets me use out there. And a mandolin, a new Gibson mandolin. But, you know, that was something that was a growing pain for me. The first year I was out with Dirks, I got a bunch of my favorite studio guitars. And, you know, being in the truck throughout a hot summer.
Oh, right.
Going from Florida to Canada.
Oh, brutal.
And then having sessions in between runs and trying to fit all these instruments on the, you know, or go pick them up from the bus or, like, fit them on the plane became a nightmare. So now I have completely separated the two instrument stockpiles.
Yeah, nice. You know. Yeah, they'll last a lot longer.
Yes, that's the truth.
Yeah. Okay, so I bet pretty much everybody watching this has heard this guitar on something.
Oddly enough, I think you're right.
What are some of the highlights?
For sure. The very first hit record I ever played on, Eric Church was making his album Chief with Jay Joyce before Jay Joyce moved to his current studio home in East Nashville. So Jay was in a basement in a house in Bellmead, which, if you know Jay, is the last place in the world you would picture him making records. But I had some mutual friends that worked with Eric and had worked with me, and they brought me in to play. And so I go to Bellmead, it's like 9 o'clock at night. I walk in with this guitar, and they're cutting what would become Like Jesus Does, which was a big early number one for him. And I think we were tuned down, so this is not the exact like voicing on the fretboard or anything, but it was an early win for me in practicing playing, well, less is more, right? And so I wait till the whole first chorus goes by, and in the turn after the first chorus I go, I'm a long gone wailing song on by.
You know, that's great.
And that was my big moment. And I remember hearing it on the radio going, wow, that's me.
You know, so did you kind of work it out before it came up, or did you just
No, it was very in the moment.
Out.
It was very in the moment. I can even tell. I'll play you on electric a thing.
God,
from
isn't that great?
It's pretty wild.
Well, you got
it?
Nothing, then suddenly, oh, there
that's
it is.
And to me, you know, especially at this stage in my journey, if there were a piece of wisdom to impart to somebody getting started right now, is to keep that in mind, the ability to pivot, it's your ears. You know, your ability to be constantly listening and responding in real time to what's happening around you and to be engaged in that. And it's, you know, it's what Keith Richards would call the weave. That is such a critical piece of the puzzle if you are going to be a session player. You know, it really, for the most part, is, are you easy to get along with and hang with? That's super important. Do you play in tune with good pocket and good tone and staying out of the way, you know, taste? Super basic stuff. But then, yeah, can you improvise with a group musically and not be so married to your idea that, you know, when you're wanting to zag and it zigs, you can zig.
Right.
And for me, that's one of my favorite things with working with Jay, whether it's someone else's record or having worked with Jay on my own records, is that if you can trust and you can be in that state of free, open-minded play, you will be surprised what happens. You know, that you're playing instinctively, not even knowing it. You know, and it takes sometimes a great producer, I think, to stop a guy like me from doing 8 more takes because I'm focused on the spot I didn't get perfect.
Right.
Frank Liddell, another great producer I got to make one of my records with, and he was always pushing me to leave in the squeak, you know, or the string noise or the flubbed note. And now when I listen back to that record or records I've played on, it's those human moments that I most gravitate towards emotionally.
Yeah. Right, right.
But yeah.
Wow, isn't it amazing? I when I was a kid, I started music playing in an orchestra in public school, and you know, where you're reading music. And I kind of thought that session musicians would go in and read something.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh no, it's just a number.
Yes.
You know, you're getting some numbers of the chord, so you're getting the tonic. And everything else, you have to just make up.
Yeah.
And you can, and it's kind of amazing when you do stuff with, you ever played on a session where there's like, you're coming into overdub and there's been like a few guitar players that come before you, and
yes,
everyone is totally different.
Totally different and totally valid.
Yeah, yeah. But like that part you did on the Eric Church thing is just so perfect and popped out like that, and it wouldn't have happened any other way. It's kind of amazing.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, for sure. Another one on this guitar is, you know, going back to Dirks, who I've had a long relationship with. After that first Eric session, he was really the first guy to call me to play on records. And on a more recent album of his, he was also one of the first to cut a song I had written, and he more recently cut a song that I had co-written based on this sort of rockin', like, if half of Audioslave and half of Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys got stranded, you know, in a club together, yeah, for 3 days and had to come up with something. And it was this. And a song called High Note that he does with Billy Strings.
So great.
But just so funky and born of a bluegrass kid that loved Southern rock too, and Skinner and all of that.
I gotta hear that song. But I bet Billy tore it up.
Billy tears it up. He tears it all the way up, singing and picking.
Oh God, that's great.
Speaking of Dirks though, I gotta tell this story. So this mandolin I had at that time in those early years when I first started getting calls for real, you know, records and stuff. And now in the summers I play this live. Dirks had called me to play on a session. It was a Monday session at 10 a.m. Sunday night, I had a gig. I had just gotten a gig playing with Vince Gill. Vince had a gig Sunday night in Milwaukee. So I call the producer. I reach out to Dirks. I was like, all right, guys, there's no way the bus is going to make it to Nashville before like noon on Monday. But I found a flight. I'm leaving Milwaukee at 4:30 in the morning, you know, whatever it is. I will be there. I might be 30 minutes late or an hour late, but I will be there for that session. And I fly from Milwaukee to Chicago. I get on the plane in Chicago that's going to get me to Nashville. And this is wintertime, and I fall asleep. I wake up 45 minutes later and I go, uh-oh, because the plane is not... we're on the ground. We're still in the gate. And we had been snowed in. And I missed that whole day.
Ooh.
I missed, you know, I wake up from that plane nap to text from Dirks like, hey, where are you? And I go, oh, dude, I got bad news. Well, it turns out he was cutting drunk on a plane that day. Ugh. And fortunately, he kept calling me back to the studio. And eventually I played. Which is throughout the whole
the
song.
Glue. Yeah.
The glue. Not the glue. Part that, you know, if somebody said, you know, they'd be go.
Yeah.
That's the sig lick.
Yeah.
But weaving it together is.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Yeah, that's such a great part because there's, I mean, it's you know, it's two notes.
I mean, so many of the great parts are, and they're kind of looped, you know, and I remember hearing Tom Bukovac talk about that. He's like, study reggae guitar players and stuff. Like, they will play the same part and will not add to it or embellish for 6 or 7 or 8 minutes. It's very meditative, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that restraint, that's the word I was looking for 5 minutes ago. Yeah. Restraint is so critical, you know?
Yeah.
You can hit that gas pedal and go 100 miles an hour, but maybe go 35.
Man, Charlie, that's it. It's like, first you learn how, then you learn when, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, restraint's a tough one.
Yeah, it is.
What strings are you running?
These are D'Addario NYXLs.
And they're D'Addario NYXL.
But they're D'Addario strings, and I've been using those for forever, and I love them.
D'Addario?
D'Addario strings as well.
D'Addario's?
Right.
D'Addario. I've been using D'Addario.
I'm a fan of D'Addario's.
Started using these D'Addario's.
I like the D'Addario NYXLs.
These are D'Addario, and I got the NYXLs on here.
Funny story with this. So it's a Parker. Parker is some guy, I think maybe out of Virginia, who builds these out of his basement maybe or something. I've never seen another Parker mandolin my whole life. But when I moved to Nashville, I was in a band with John Osborne from Brothers Osborne.
Yeah.
And I had that D28, which those big scratches are from John. So he was always borrowing this.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, he was always borrowing that and playing it really hard. And I was always borrowing this, his mandolin.
Oh.
And his Strat, which happened to be his first electric, 70 Strat that's heavier than most Les Pauls somehow. Yeah. And eventually, he's not as much a Strat guy, and he was selling some instruments, and he was selling this in a Strat, so I bought him.
Oh, how cool.
Keep it in the family, you know. But I love this mandolin, and it's opened up in the years I've played it, you know. Love the mandolin. I love the percussive element.
You're right. Yeah, yeah. That is that's the bluegrass snare, man.
Yes, it is.
That's great.
Yeah.
So what pick are you using now?
Well, this is that custom version of the Dunlop, this 96 millimeter or 0.96 millimeter. But you know, if I'm really committing myself to bluegrass mandolin, I'm going to play this blue chip for sure.
Yeah.
You get more volume and body out of it, you know. But I learned years ago that Sam Bush just plays a Fender medium pick on his mandolin.
Yeah.
So I try to keep that open mind.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, Sam is just like touched by the hand of God, man.
Yeah. He has vibe and musicality and stories for days and days.
Yeah.
And it's just the best presence in any situation for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that sounds great, man. Oh,
thanks.
Yeah. Well, what else is over there?
Yeah, while
Let's
we're in sort of
more
acoustic
of this cool.
Acoustic world, this is a more recent acquisition, and I love this thing. This guy, James Burkett, down in Alabama, builds these little TERS acoustics, and I was not aware of what the TERS is. Apparently Martin made a bunch of these way back in the day.
Yeah.
But the nut is capo 3 on a regular acoustic.
Oh, really?
So this is B flat.
Wow.
But it just sits so nice.
Yeah.
And you can get it way up there on the neck in a way you can't if you're playing a regular acoustic. You know, you need to get, you know, that's B flat. So that's going to be C, D, E. So you want to play a G shape. You know, you'd be on the 12th fret
if
you had a regular.
Right.
And being a guy with a bluegrass background, I tend to play a G chord first anyway.
Oh, sure.
So it's nice to have.
In fact, when you opened up in the key of C, I thought, well, that's not very bluegrass.
Yeah. It's. I've been obsessed with the Tony Rice C-shape tunes from his catalog.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's good to have a like continuing education.
So Yeah.
But yeah, I love this thing, and it's great for like a second acoustic or in lieu of a 12 string if you don't want that full 12 string steamroller situation.
Wow, what a pretty guitar. Yeah,
yeah, handmade by James Burkett down there in Alabama.
Okay, cool.
He fixes up those old Harmony Sovereigns as well.
Oh, okay, yes.
And this is a cool guy. I may not even put my banjo picks on, but this is an Ohm open back banjo. And what I really wanted was...
No, I'm sorry, who? What?
Oh, Ohm?
Ohm. Wow, I love those inlays.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's kind of meant to be, or, you know, they make these to be clawhammer. I'm not a clawhammer player, but...
Oh.
But I have, Deering makes low banjo strings, inspired by John Hartford.
Wow.
And so I need to get the banjo picks for this after all, but I love being able to play a regular 5-string banjo in a key that isn't G, A, or B, which are your typical banjo keys, and still be out of that open G tuning shape.
Yeah.
And have access to that lower register, which you don't really get on a typical five string.
Cool.
And kind of mellow and plunky.
I love that.
But
cool.
And I have a regular five string that I play that's more bluegrass oriented, you know, and is right for certain applications. But
sure.
That one has really helped me
be
able to play banjo and not be cutting off people's heads, you know.
Yeah. It's really something to hear that kind of warm bottom end.
Yeah.
Very unusual to banjo
for sure. Yeah. But anybody who is hip to John Harper records, which I highly recommend listening to, there's a whole world to explore there with the low banjo. This went up for sale at Carter, and I should plug this one in. Now I put flat wound strings on this one.
Really?
I did, and the reason I did, one of the first times I was ever just a fly on the wall in a session, was at the old Omni Sound Studio, and Dan Dugmore was there in the utility chair that day, and he was playing mandolin, and on a break I just was kind of listening in on a conversation. He was talking to one of the other players, and he said, yeah, you don't have to get a good mandolin, you just get a cheap mandolin, put some flat wounds on it. He's like, it makes it sound more expensive automatically and kind of sweeter. And he's right, you know. I had at the time like a $200 mandolin. I went and put flat wounds on it, and it played and sounded much better on a microphone.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, pretty wild. It's a fun thing to feel playing as well, just to, on the neck of a mandolin. But this is a 60s Gibson, I think they call it an EM-150.
Huh.
Now, I used to have an EM-200 from the 60s, which is the solid body version of this, and that's a P90, and the EM-200 has a P90 in it too. And it, you know, 5, it sounds like an electric mandolin. At 10, it sounds like a mini Les Paul. This one has just got a little more to offer for a microphone. Not that it's going to cut in a bluegrass band.
Sure.
But it's something enough that you can put a mic on it, and it makes sense to do so. But I love blending that with this P90 sound. And this actually belonged to Sam Bush.
Really?
And that's what I was like, all right, I'm going to sell my EM-200.
Sold!
Buy the EM-150. And I love this thing. And then kind of crank it. Volume is a little... See if this doesn't kill us. So yeah, you can get like rocking on it if you want, you know. It's a fun instrument to have.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
That's great.
But yeah.
So Charlie, what, Susie, you said banjo was your first instrument.
Yep.
And then mandolin and guitar kind of worked in?
Yes. So I wanted to, I was fortunate my parents took me to see Vince Gill in concert probably a dozen times.
Good parents.
Throughout my childhood. Good parents. My dad took me to my first rock and roll concert. It was before it became the world's largest Bass Pro, the Pyramid in Memphis.
Yeah.
And it was the Rolling Stones
with
Johnny Lang opening. Pretty awesome experience for me. And raised me on their record collections and all of that. But from the minute I saw Vince play, and really before that, it was watching my dad play in a local band that he played in, a cover band, and the guy that played electric in that band would sing Werewolves of London and play the solo with his teeth.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the moment I knew what I wanted to do, you know, the rest of my life.
Sure.
So it was, Mom, can I please get an electric guitar? Can I please get an electric guitar, you know? And we would come up to Nashville a lot. At the time, we had Opryland Theme Park was still happening. And they had all these great live music shows amongst the rides. And then you go in and see the Opry that night. Well, Mike Snyder had a show playing banjo with his bluegrass band. And all the way up to Nashville on that trip. I was like, can I please get an electric guitar? Please get an electric guitar. I see Mike Snyder play a banjo. All the way home, can I please get a banjo? And so I got a banjo. And it was one of the better things to happen to me in my musical life, because the discipline required to get a decent sound with your right hand on a banjo helped me develop a focus and a dedication to the technical side that served me so much better than had I gotten that electric guitar and been able to just make a loud noise.
Yeah.
You know? It was that delayed gratification. But yeah, I would accumulate different instruments over the next few years until that fateful day that I got my $100 in tips and bought a Telecaster.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that is something. On electric guitar, there's so many cheats and workarounds that you can, you know, we can all kind of fumble by and sound pretty good. But man,
it's
acoustic instruments are very unforgiving.
It's much harder to get around that, I think, you know, especially on a banjo. And I had the good fortune of, you know, a couple of years into playing banjo, stumbling across Larry Wallace, who was my longtime banjo teacher, who was a 10-year veteran of Jimmy Martin, the King of Bluegrass's band. Sure. He was a Sunny Mountain boy. And so I learned from the best.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't even let me play banjo the first three lessons. We just talked theory. And technicality, you know, and like, you need to hit that pick even on the string, you know, and all these great things that served me really well later. And before that, I took piano lessons like a lot of kids do.
Yeah.
And I took to that in a way that I didn't with any of the athletic endeavors, you know. I was not coordinated unless it was this way. And those piano lessons served me well. Even though I don't really play and practice these days, I still visualize music on a keyboard.
Yeah, that's great.
So,
Well, what else is over there?
I love this guitar. I'm glad we're going to talk about it.
The 3-bolt. Yeah, 3-bolt.
Yeah. And this thing's heavy, too.
Oh, God. No wonder John sold it.
Yeah, right. But I somehow just fused to this instrument early on.
That is a hog, man.
It is. Recently, actually, John mailed me this. He sent this black pickguard, which is what was on it when he bought it. And I had a white pickguard on it, or it had a white pickguard on it when I acquired it from him. But, you know, what I love, you can see here in the plate on the back, JTO, John Thomas Osborne.
That's great.
And his dad bought this for him. And kind of like that Martin was for me, you know, a parent's way of saying, you're doing this, you know, keep going. But that Jay Joyce session where I ended up playing on Like Jesus Does, the other song I was called to play on, and actually this might have been the first song, because I remember walking in, it was nighttime, somebody's smoking a bowl, you know, there's like, the band is over here and there's a cloud of smoke.
Well, I mean, it is a session.
It's a session, it's 9 p.m., it's an Eric session.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just like wide-eyed, like I've not really been on a record session before. And to my knowledge, like record sessions happened at 10 and 2 in the daylight, you know, so this was a whole different world.
Yeah, nighttime, whole different day.
But I walk in and Jay's like, all right, we got the song. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, what do you want me to chart it? And he's like, no. And he hands me the chord. This chord is going to some amplifier I can't see, some rig I can't see. And I have this guitar. And he hits play or record.
Were there a couple pedals in front of you? Or
I might have brought a pedal board with me. I think all I had was compression and some slap, like this would be here. So the song starts, and he's just like, go. And so I start playing, and I think, well, I'm just going to warm up, get my ears around the song.
Sure.
You know, so. Oh, Lord, let me get it. It was in F too, so I was like, I'm not gonna put a capo on this. And it was Eric's song, Keep On. And that was what I played. I thought, that was kind of cool, but I'll get my real part.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's like, all right, that was cool, man. Let's play it again. And so I play it a second time. Okay, that's gonna be something. I go to play again, and now I'm thinking, all right, this is my first real take. He's like, hey, you're done. You're good, man. And that was another lesson of just like, you know, got to make every note count.
Yeah.
And you can't take it too seriously. You know, I've heard Brian Sutton talk a lot about just embracing that failure could happen any moment. Like, instead of like shying from that and getting more careful and closed off, like lean into it and let it happen.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're playing with you know, no abandon, you know, it's just wild abandon or whatever, your emotion's going to poke through a lot better that way, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay, that's a great story, man.
Yeah, man.
And a great guitar.
Really cool guitar. Love this guitar.
Yeah, yeah. I love that you got it from John. That's great. So you guys, basically, you're coming up together about the same time.
For sure. Yeah. And that's, to me, one of the best things about this town and this business and the way that it unfolds in Nashville still. You know, we are a bastion for full band live sessions.
Yeah.
Any given day.
The last one.
Really the last one. Yeah. And, you know, for me, it was playing on a lot of bad demos.
Yeah.
To get to where I was graduated enough and ready to take on better songs and bigger records. And you build so many great memories that way, too.
Right.
Coming up with your friends. And all boats really do rise on that tide. I mean, there's a competitive spirit in town. But we also haven't lost sight of the fact that we aren't in the zero-sum game.
Yeah.
We are all benefiting together. And we all win together.
Yeah, that is great. Yeah, Nashville is such a wonderful community.
Yeah.
So the last thing in your boat is your electric.
Now, this is a great story, too.
Okay.
And I don't often get called. I was trying to think about how to describe to you, John, you know, my role in Nashville when it comes to electric guitar. I am not the vanilla ice cream or the chocolate or the strawberry. I'm like 15 flavors in, man. Some, you know, Oreo crunch combo. In that, you know, I'm not able to switch gears as quickly and with as much precision as, you know, the cats that sit in those chairs like Derek Wells and Rob McNally and Bukovac and Jed Hughes. But I love playing electric. And every once in a while, I'm the right guy, you know, for the role or whatever. And I have had some good electrics over the years. But going back to that year, 2019, playing with Vince, I had had a couple experiences getting to play in Vince's band up to that point. And I remember the first time I got the chance to do that, and Vince being my all-time hero. It's come on, man, I've died and gone to hillbilly heaven. But Vince calls me ahead of rehearsal and said, "Hey man, if you got anything you want to try out, you know, I got a bunch of guitars, like just let me know. And, you know, you can borrow something while we're out on these gigs." And so my gears are turning, you know, like, how do I ask not for everything, you know,
right?
Well, I'd like a black Gartelli, maybe a white Gartelli, maybe a thin line, what do you have? And the Strats, and we got to get all the Gibson, you know, but I was really eaten up with Freddie King at the time and just over the moon for 335s, and I had a Heritage 535, I guess would be their model, which actually plays great, and it was a really good guitar and the best guitar I owned at the time. But I told Vince, I was like, "Man, I've never really owned a truly great vintage 335, and I would love to get to play one." So I show up for rehearsal, and this guitar is sitting on the stand.
Wow!
And I spend 2-3 weekends that first year I played with him, you know, just in heaven, playing this guitar, learning it, and didn't see it, didn't think about it, you know, for years. A couple years later, I'm getting married, and, I get a call from Vince, and just off the cuff, he's like, "Man, when you get a chance, come by the house, man, I got a little wedding gift for you." And so I'm driving down to Vince and Amy's house thinking, "Man, I bet they got me and Kristen like the nicest toaster anybody's ever seen." You know, like she would toast 8 slices on different settings at once, you know, and Bluetooth and all that.
Yeah.
Well, I walk in and it's this guitar.
Oh, that's
and it's
cool.
Sitting in a case. And I see Amy on the way in. She said, "Yeah, he changed the strings on it last night. And he's sitting with me and we're talking and I'm just bawling." And he had played this guitar on the Crossroads with Sting up in New York for CMT. And of course I had played it, you know, when I was borrowing it. And he just said, "You know, you deserve to have a really great electric you can play." And he gave it to me. He told me the story how he got it. He was coming home from a gig in Oklahoma somewhere. Somebody had reached out to him online and said, "Hey, I got my dad's old 335. I don't know much about it, but, you know, I'm here in so-and-so, middle of nowhere, Oklahoma." And Vince is like, I'm going to be coming through on the way home from a gig. And this guy's an EMT that he's buying this thing from. So I think Vince's bus must have like just pulled into a truck stop.
Sure.
Somewhere in the middle of Oklahoma.
Did the deal.
In comes the ambulance. The EMT hops out, pulls a gold spray painted case with this guitar in it out of the back. And Vince buys the guitar, and I call it my Excalibur, and
oh, it's great.
I try to be worthy of it, you know.
What year is it? Do you know?
It is a 1960 dot neck.
Oh,
I forget which is which, but one of these pickups is original, and one Vince got from his when he was in the Time Jumpers, Andy Reese, great guitar player that plays in the Time Jumpers.
What is this crazy thing there?
This is a Joe Glazer modification that helps I think with like intonation, and I'm the world's worst on technical stuff. I think keeps from any of the like the extra ringing and stuff.
Overtone.
Yeah. But yeah, that was a Joe Glazer contraption there.
That's so great.
Yeah, and you know, it's beat up, but man, it's like, and I'll need to work on the binding at some point.
Beat up by Vince Gill.
Beat up by Vince Gill and some dude driving an ambulance in Oklahoma. Yeah. His dad, you know. But you know, it's just, it's a well-loved guitar, and it's more than anything, it's a reminder of how to be.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
And, you know, may I be so lucky someday to have an embarrassment, I already have an embarrassment of riches, but to be in a position to give that affirmation to somebody coming into town to make their mark on music.
That is great.
But yeah.
I think Vince's first good electric was a 335 his parents gave him.
It sure was. A red, cherry red,
I think. Cherry red.
And he still has it.
Back to the Let Me Love You Tonight Pure Prairie League days. Was it Pure Prairie League?
That's it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
God.
Pretty wild. He played in a lot of folks' bands before being the Vince Gill we all know, you know.
Yeah.
And now he's an Eagle, you know.
Yeah, now he's an Eagle, right?
Yeah, right back to where
while
he started.
While he's at it.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a great instrument. And
hey, let's hear that thing a little bit.
Yeah, man. This bridge pickup really.
PAFs almost have that big Tele thing going.
Well, that is something I was learning about 335s around the time this became mine, is that, you know, your volume control right here is its own tone library.
Sure.
And yes. Well, here's this compressor. So pulling that back.
Yeah.
Got all that room to go. It gets real spanky. Down there. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it, man.
Yeah, man.
And what an amazing story.
So wild.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful.
Hey, so right now, just for the watchers at home, you're plugged into this Princeton.
Yeah, and this is a great reissue. Man, Fender, I think, is just making some killer amps right now.
Oh,
I love their hand-wired tweed. Champ that they have, I keep that on hand at the house.
Yeah,
sounds really big on a microphone.
Sure.
I love this Princeton reverb, and that was another one of those just morsels of wisdom from Tom Bukovac of like, he's just like, man, just get you a Princeton reverb, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And I've played this on a lot on the Eric Church Heart and Soul record. That was my amp, whether I was playing electric or playing acoustics through it. And that's my starting point. I did fall in love with Tweed Deluxes over the last few years, and this is not an original, but my buddy Joe Morgan, who makes Morgan Amps, for fun, started Nashville Amp Works to recreate those just golden era Fender amp circuits. And what happened, I borrowed, John Osborne has a great Tweed Deluxe, and I borrowed his and got hooked. And right about that time, Tweed Deluxes like doubled in price. They're just crazy. And about that time, Joe Morgan posted about him making these, and so I called Joe. And I probably play this on live gigs more than anything these days.
Yeah.
But I just love small combos. I could stand to learn a lot more about the different amps out there and the tones they can create. But again, I think my role in the community here is more of the acoustic guy who can plug into an amp and who can be your electric guy if you want something a little more left-footed.
Yeah.
Whereas all the other cats I listed, you know, they know how to be an encyclopedia of tone.
And
get you to dial up anything you need.
But, you know, the outlier can come up with that weird, cool part that
yes.
is not on their radar.
For sure. Know? And that might, I would argue, is maybe one of my strengths in, yeah. in that, you know, I have these bluegrass roots. I grew up loving Southern rock, but I am more curious than I am ignorant, you know.
yeah.
And somehow I've got that ratio of ignorance and curiosity dialed to an advantage.
Yeah, well, man, is it working.
Well, thank you.
Well, God, I'm so glad we could hang, and congratulations on the new album and everything else that's going on. I mean, man, what a run.
Thank you, John. Thanks for letting me talk and tell all these stories. I love the series. I'm proud to be included.
All right, great.
Amongst so many friends of mine and people I just respect for days. And I love what y'all are doing for the viewers watching because, you know, I grew up a kid in the 90s, and towards the tail end of my growing up years, you know, in high school, YouTube was born. But I just think about the incredible resource that is, and for people who produce the kind of content y'all produce, you are teaching the next generation so much.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing that there's all this information out there now. When before, I mean, I don't know, when I was a kid, you'd have to like ride your bike to find somebody with a guitar to teach you a G
sure.
chord.
And I do believe in, you know, having to... In my case, it was like rewind on the cassette or
right.
you know, hit the skip button and hold it down on the CD.
Yeah.
But like learning that way strictly by ear helped me so much.
Great training.
But
yeah.
there's also something to be said for being able to find that video and know how they did it, you know. And
yeah.
if you combine those two methods of learning, it's really powerful.
Oh, yeah.
But y'all do a lot to put that good stuff into the world. So.
Well, thank you, man. Thank you. Well, y'all, till next time.